Genesis is very much concerned about origins. In Genesis 1 and 2, you get the origin of life. You get the names of the first two image bearers, Adam and Eve. Moving some chapters later to Genesis 10, there's what's called a table of nations, reporting all kinds of peoples and nations that come from certain names. Passages like Genesis 19, it's another example where Lot's daughters are named, and they help us understand where the Ammonites and the Moabites later came from. And there are all kinds of examples we could show. The readers of Genesis are learning as they read the book where certain nations and peoples come from, where they've been sourced to. Certain people that headed up a lineage that really gained much traction and sometimes became a whole nation. In Genesis 29 and 30, the two chapters which comprise our passage tonight, just parts of each of them, we're learning where the nation of Israel came from. Jacob is later renamed Israel. And you have a lot of children that we're looking at. From him and from his children will arise the nation of the Israelites. Well, how important is that to read about? My goodness, the Ammonites and the Moabites, understanding their origin is certainly one thing, but they pale in comparison to the importance of Israel. How important is Israel in the Old Testament storyline? Well, from Exodus to Malachi, it's pretty much the entirety of the storyline. Following their arrival in the Promised Land, after they'd been escaping Egyptian captivity, and all of life in the Promised Land as it later divided and as people were exiled and returned, prophet after prophet, psalmist after psalmist, all kinds of kings, the storyline of Israel, absolutely crucial. The Israelites who are reading this from the hand of Moses are Israelites that had been delivered from Exodus. So I just want you to think about, in terms of timeline, these Israelites have been delivered under Moses from the Egyptian captivity, and they're going to read the history of what God had done and covenanted, what promises he had made. And lo and behold, in this story, they're going to see how Israel, and this person here, Jacob, had children, and how these descendants is where they are from. This is a way of sort of dusting off the family genealogy, if you will, if you're one of those Israelites, and you're reading about how all of these branches are taking you back to, okay, we came from him. We came from him. So this is what God was doing. So when these births were happening and these generations were unfolding, they were leading to us. That's what these Israelites would see. Note that the number of children born tonight, number 12, when you count the names, you might know on the board, wait a second, there's a Dinah. What's going on there? Okay, she wasn't heading up one of the tribes of Israel. Okay, fair enough. There are other things that are going to happen after this chapter, but the number 12 is still significant. This is foreshadowing the Israelites. Okay? Now, Dinah will have a different role, but she's mentioned here because of Genesis 34 that's coming. But nonetheless, the number 12 seems very important. Also, because each of these children are born outside the Promised Land. Remember, Jacob went to go find a wife, worked for Laban for 7 years, and then woke up after his wedding night, and he was married to the wrong woman. Laban had tricked him, and he was married to Leah. And then he said he agreed to work for 7 more years if he could have Rachel. So he then married Rachel immediately, and now having 2 wives, he's going to work for 7 more years. Everything we're going to read about tonight takes place over the second set of 7 years. Jacob has 12 children with 4 wives in 7 years. I want you to soak that in for a moment. 12 children, 4 wives, 7 years. It's incredible. And from these people will descend the Israelites from which the Messiah will come. So greater things are happening here than some of the weirdness of this particular story. And there's weirdness here. There's weirdness here because the two main wives, Leah and Rachel, seem to be in competition with one another. They seem to be battling. One Old Testament scholar called this a section of birth wars. birth battles, where the women, and when they find themselves unable to bear at a certain point, they give him one of their servants as a wife, so that that servant will have children to represent the main wife, and therefore you have four wives by the time this story is over, and 12 children born in 7 years. The one who's not born, that will be born later, is Benjamin. Rachel will have him. But the number 12 is significant for the reasons that I've given. These two sisters struggle with each other. But sibling rivalry is not new here in the story of Genesis. It goes all the way back to Cain and Abel. There's some sibling tension with Ham and then Shem and Japheth and how they treated Noah in Genesis 9. There's some issue with Isaac and Ishmael. There's sibling rivalry with Jacob and Esau. And these two sisters as well, Rachel and Leah. So sibling rivalry is a big theme in Genesis. It features in one generation after another, and then sometimes not just between brothers, but sisters, as in here. And you know what's going to happen when Joseph is born, when Joseph's brothers are featured in Genesis 37 onward? More sibling strife between Joseph and his brothers. Genesis, quite literally, from the beginning to the end, is characterized by these kinds of family tensions. We just want to observe that because these features are worth noting as a reader, that they help you make connections and see parallels from one story to the next. This particular story begins and ends with references about Rachel's situation. Look in chapter 29, verse 30. It tells us, or verse 31, excuse me, chapter 29, 31. It tells us at the end of that verse that Rachel was barren. Well, now at the end of the passage that we're looking tonight, in verses 22 to 24, God remembers Rachel, listens to her, and opens her womb. So at the beginning of the story, her barrenness is highlighted. And at the end of the story, God has overcome her barrenness. So framing our account is this great difficulty that Rachel has. Leah does not seem to have as much difficulty having children, either from herself and certainly through her servant. So these two sisters seek to overcome each other. And one other observation to make about the story are the names. So I put the names on the board. I don't know if this would be helpful or not, but I've listed these names. I hope I'm not in the way. Probably am. But these names all have some significance to the circumstances. They're word plays. So the names that they're giving are in some way connected to what the women are feeling and what they're evaluating the circumstances to mean. One last point before we look at these births. Each of these 12 children are born outside the promised land. I was about to speak about this a moment ago, and then I derailed myself. When these children are born outside the promised land, this is encouraging to the Israelites because Jacob and these children are going to go to the promised land. But when the Israelites are reading this, they're also outside the promised land. And just as they've been redeemed out of Egypt in the book of Exodus, they are not in the promised land, but are going to head toward it. It's as if this little family is a bigger representation of than just itself of what's going to happen for Israel. Okay, they're outside the promised land, so will Israel be. But this family is going to go into the promised land, just like Israel is going to as well. The five parts that I put on the board are according to the different wives. Four children from Leah, two from Bilhah, two from Zilpah, three more from Leah, and then finally one from Rachel. You add them all up and you get 12. In verses 31 to 35, here's the account about the four children from Leah. We're told that when the Lord saw Leah was hated, now hated by whom? Well, hated by Jacob. Now, hate is probably a strong word in the way we think about it, that he would have just loathed her presence. That's probably not true. The sense of hate here can be translated softer than that. And I think sometimes people over-exaggerate, or I could just say exaggerate, the idea of what Jacob's feelings toward her are, that he just can't stand her presence. I don't think that's the case. Just as earlier in Genesis 29, we're told that Leah's eyes are soft, whereas Rachel's beauty may have been much more striking. So while he loves Rachel, he does not hate Leah in the sense of a spectrum where hatred at one end is the opposite of love at the other end. We should see it as he loved Rachel more, and that is clear in the statement here certainly clear. It tells us that when the Lord saw this, he opened her womb. So Jacob has a wife that he did not prefer. And in an ironic twist of the story, the Lord is going to show favor here in this account to the, what you might consider, the unpreferred, unloved wife. This isn't Jacob's plan. It's an unplanned marriage, and she's not loved like Rachel is. But Leah is going to be crucial to the storyline. But it tells us Rachel is barren. Rachel is barren. Now, any time the Bible makes reference to a woman who's barren, you need to get ready. Because the reason for pointing the barrenness out is for God to then act. It was that way with Sarah. She was barren. It's that way with Rebecca. She was barren. It's that way with Rachel. It's going to be that way with Hannah in 1 Samuel. It's going to be that way with Samson's mother. There are five referenced barren women in the Old Testament. Though certainly there would have been more barren women than that. The reason the Old Testament identifies those five, Sarah, Rebecca, Rachel, Hannah, and Samson's mother, is because God reverses the barrenness in every case they're mentioned. And here, Rachel's barrenness is going to be reversed at the end of the passage. So the reference to barrenness prepares us for God to act. And in verse 32, Leah conceives and bears a son. Here's the first one, named Reuben. Reuben basically means, look, a son. And significantly, then, she names him what you would maybe point out and then say to someone, look, there's a son. And Reuben is appropriate as a name. But it tells us here, she said, because the Lord has looked upon my affliction, for now my husband will love me. You know, she sees her affliction not in terms of ability to have children. She seems to be fertile. What she sees as affliction is the fact that she's not loved like Rachel's loved. And she says, now my husband will love me. She's actually thinking that if I'm able to bear children for my husband, that will win his affection for me. That's what she's hoping. You can almost feel really sorrowful for Leah here, can't you? Because she wants to be loved. What wife doesn't want to be loved? And Leah doesn't feel loved. Leah wants to be loved, and she says, well, now I have Reuben. The Lord has seen my affliction, and now my husband will love me. Well, we get a sense that it didn't happen the way she hoped because of verse 33. Child number two, she conceived again and bore a son. And said, because the Lord has heard that I'm hated, he's given me this son also. So again, she's thinking the Lord is in some way addressing her affliction of being hated by her husband in that way. Not love like Rachel. And she's hoping that the Lord's favor here is going to reverse her husband's heart. And he is going to be loving and affectionate toward her. That's what she wants. So the Lord has heard. Well, now maybe Jacob will attend. Tells us in verse 34. She conceived and bore a son and said, now this time my husband will be attached to me. The language is lessening. I don't know if you've noticed that as we've read. She talks in verse 32 about being loved. And then she doesn't mention that in verse 33. She just refers to the fact that she's hated. And in verse 34, she says, now this time my husband will be attached to me. Which is a lowering of expectations quite significantly. Doesn't speak about being greatly embraced and loved by the husband. She seems to at least say, maybe he will be there in some sort of presence in terms of attachment. Maybe he will attach himself. The word Levi means attachment. So she's naming the child, right, in light of the circumstances and her feelings about them. Though she seems to have lowered her expectations. But child number five is most striking. She doesn't mention anything about Jacob loving her. Doesn't even mention anything about her affliction. She says in verse 35, after bearing a son, this time I will praise the Lord. Because the route that she's been on, hoping to win the love of her husband by bearing children, does not seem to be successful. So she bore a son, and she called him Judah. And then she ceased bearing. We would be mistaken to say she ceased bearing because now she's barren. She may have given up, or there seems to be indication later in the chapter that Rachel has some control over the sexual relations between Jacob and the wives because of a certain exchange of mandrakes and a night with Jacob that's going to be offered later. So it could be that Jacob is simply no longer engaging in that level of intimacy with Leah, though she has borne four children. So we might feel sorry for Leah here, but the Lord is at work. Let's just point out two of these sons, Levi and Judah. Hello, these are really important for the history of Israel. So if you're an Israelite and you're a first reader of Genesis and you've come out from the Exodus, one of the things you learn is that Aaron is your high priest. And the priests are going to come from the Levites. Well, here's Levi himself born. You also learn at the end of Genesis, and the Exodus generation would learn this as well, that the tribe of Judah is a royal tribe. And in Genesis 49, they're told that the scepter will never depart from Judah, and all of the kings that ruled from Jerusalem, from David onward, were all from the tribe of Judah. They were rightful kings in that sense. So here's an unplanned marriage. Here's an unloved wife. And she gives birth to Levi and to Judah. Now, in her affliction, she has no idea what the Lord is going to do with these two sons. And she's already born four. So the priesthood and the royal kingship, major Old Testament institutions that are foreshadowed with the birth of these two sons. Now, in chapter 30, we move to verses 1 to 8, where there are two children from Bilhah. It tells us that when Rachel saw that she, her Rachel, bore Jacob no children, she envied her sister. What she's going to say then comes from jealousy and envy. And she says to Jacob, "Give me children or I shall die." Now, she's exaggerating, but I think that you can see her point of distress. She is so worked up by this. She said, "I don't know if I even want to continue living if I can't bear you any children." All she sees is Leah. Leah's feeding four children and Leah's taking care of four children. And Rachel hates that she can't bear him. And so she says, "Give me children or I shall die." But Jacob knows theologically what she might be omitting with that kind of statement. In fact, he gets angry at this Rachel whom he loves so much. He's angry with her and he says, "Am I in the place of God who's withheld from you the fruit of the womb?" And I think it's right when Old Testament scholars say this is a kind of rebuke. He doesn't want her anger toward him. She's frustrated. And so he's angry in response. And he reminds her of a crucial theological point, and he says, "God is sovereign over this. Am I in the place of God?" So they need to trust, and then see later on in the chapter, of how the Lord in his providence is going to bring a child at the appropriate time for Rachel. But Rachel has an idea in verse 3, and we've heard this all before. Here's a barren woman, and she says, "Wait, I got this servant." What does that sound like? Genesis 16, Abraham, Hagar, Sarah. Sarah can't have any children. Oh, here's the servant Hagar, and Abraham does. And so here, Jacob is like an Abraham as this story is being told. We're able to see that kind of connection. In fact, the language is very similar to that episode if you look in Genesis 16, too. So that's just a reference for you. We won't turn there, but just to note how closely connected, even with the language, that those stories are with this verse in verse 3. "Here's my servant Bilhah, go into her, so that she may give birth on my behalf, and that even I may have children through her." The idea is surrogacy. Bilhah will simply provide the womb, and this will be a kind of adoption that Rachel is going to have. So this will be Rachel's child, she's thinking, through Bilhah, her servant. And so, she gives Bilhah as a wife to Jacob in verse 4. And they have relations. And we're told in verse 5 and 6 that she conceives and bears Jacob a son. Then Rachel says, "Well, God has judged me and heard my voice in giving me a son." Now, sometimes when you see something like "God judged me," that sounds immediately like a negative thing. God has judged me, and that's not something I would want. But it's also possible to say God has judged you or given a judgment on your behalf. In other words, he's acted and judged in such a way for you. It's a way of saying he's vindicating you, maybe. The judgment is for you and not actually against you. When Bilhah has a child, it's as if Rachel says, God has vindicated me. I'm in my barren state and God has rendered a judgment. He's heard my voice and given me a son. So the phrase, he's heard my voice and given me a son, affirms and confirms that being judged by God here is a good thing. She's being given a positive judgment of vindication. And in verses 5 and 6, we also learn that she called his name Dan. The word Dan means judged. So again, don't you have the sense of these children being named by the parents in terms of the circumstances or the feelings of the mother? Here in verses 7 and 8, Rachel's servant Bilhah conceives again and bore Jacob a second son. Then Rachel said, with mighty wrestlings I wrestled with my sister and have prevailed. This rivalry between the sisters is made very graphic here. It's like they are contending with each other in mortal combat. You know, they're wrestling and they are engaged and they are one trying to triumph over the other. And Rachel says here, with mighty wrestlings, I wrestled with my sister and have prevailed. And so she names this child Naphtali. Naphtali means wrestlings. So Rachel believes that she has been in a great contest with Leah and now is proclaiming victory. This is why, as I said earlier, Old Testament scholars look at this and they say birth wars, birth battles. Like they're just trying to up the other one, you know. And here, Rachel is declaring victory. I think it's worth noting that while Rachel seems to come out in this moment here as the successful one in the wrestling match, later on Jacob will be wrestling also. Not in this chapter. He's going to wrestle with this figure in a few chapters and prevail as well. So the language is the same. It's an interesting literary connection, I think. So she's naming this child Naphtali, which means wrestlings. We move to the third section where two children now come from Zilpah. So Leah saw that she had ceased bearing children. We don't know how long that she hasn't borne them. We know she already has had four sons. We don't know how long, though, she has waited before this next act is made. But it tells us that Leah saw she had ceased bearing children, and she took her servant Zilpah and gave her to Jacob as a wife. This is exactly what Leah had done, right? We should now look at, as we zoom out, four wives, right? Leah, Rachel, Bilhah, and Zilpah. Four wives. 12 children in 7 years. In verses 10 and 11, Leah's servant Zilpah bore Jacob a son. And Leah said, good fortune has come. So she called his name Gad, which means good fortune. And in verses 12 and 13, Leah's servant Zilpah bore Jacob a second son. And Leah said, happy am I, for women have called me happy. And she called his name Asher, and Asher means happy. I think all of these word plays are significant because these aren't randomly chosen names, right? They're all fitting these circumstances. Beginning in verse 14, something is recorded here that disrupts the rhythm. Up to this point, there's been a report of this woman having a child and these women having children and back and forth from one person to the next. But in verses 14 and following, there's a disruption of that as a brief story is told. And this is very important. In verses 14 and following, in the days of wheat harvest, Reuben, she's the first son born, right? Leah's son, firstborn. He goes out and he finds mandrakes in the field. He's less than 7 years old. Right? He's Jensen or smaller. Okay, so he's a young boy. He's going out, he's finding mandrakes, which were believed to be an aphrodisiac and could not only help with creating the environment and mood of intimacy, but could even help with fertility, so people thought. And so to come upon mandrakes, and if there's a woman in a situation that wasn't able to have children, she might try it if she's trying anything else. So Reuben finds mandrakes in the field, brings them to Leah, and Rachel, who is barren, Rachel says, please give me some of your son's mandrakes. So she sees, bells are going off. She's thinking, I'm going to try this. Give me some of your son's mandrakes. But Leah says to her, is it a small matter that you've taken away my husband? Okay, what has happened here in the marriage? Is it a small matter that you've taken away my husband? This is a clue that over the course of these years, over the course of this second set of 7 years, now Jacob is married to four women right now, but in some way Rachel has exercised a kind of dominance toward Jacob to the degree that Leah feels Jacob has been taken from her. Now, we don't know when that happened. We don't know what that looked like. We don't know what kind of conversations took place. All we have is that statement there, and it makes the reader go, wait a second. I mean, we probably could have guessed that not all is right in the house, but definitely we know all is not right at the house. Is it a small matter that you've taken away my husband? You want my son's mandrakes also? I mean, she's put off by the fact that Rachel's asking for the mandrakes. And Leah, she's mad anyway about having Jacob taken away. And so when mandrakes are brought up, well, she's bringing up another issue as well. By the way, you've taken away my husband. You want my son's mandrakes too, don't you? Rachel, this doesn't put Rachel in a very positive light. But Rachel then says, well, then he may lie with you tonight in exchange for your son's mandrakes. Rachel seems to be giving permission. Now, wait a second. This, again, is a clue that something strange is happening and that Leah and Jacob would not have maybe at this point just had what a husband and wife would for a child, perhaps. And here, Rachel's giving permission. Well, then he may lie with you. And here's the exchange. Exchange for your son's mandrakes. Now, of course, Rachel's going to use these mandrakes for a future night. But look, Leah has ceased bearing children. What are the chances? Right? So Rachel says he may lie with you tonight. So Jacob comes in from the field. And something new is there. There's Leah. And Leah's going out to meet him. And she says, you must come into me, for I've hired you with my son's mandrakes. The whole language here is so strange. I've hired you? With fruit? I mean, this is odd, right? So he lay with her that night. And God listened to Leah. And she conceived and bore Jacob a fifth son. Oh, Rachel must have been livid. Just one night, and then give me the mandrakes. And Rachel's plan is, okay, this will help the fertility, it'll be an aphrodisiac, and it will all... And then Leah, on that night, conceives. The son is named Issachar. Leah says, God has given me my wages because I've gave my servant to my husband. So it's interesting that she uses the word wages, because mandrakes were basically purchasing this night. She's a wife, but apparently this is the circumstances and the agreed upon set of relationships and boundaries. It's very odd. But she names him Issachar, which means he provides a wage. So his name Issachar has to do with wages. She does seem to recognize the providence of God. Leah says, God has given me my wages. It's not that she would deny that from the first four sons, but here's son number five from this one woman. And you know what happened in verses 19 and 20? Leah conceived again. I don't know how that happened. There's no other story that sets that up, like verses 14 to 21 set up son number five. But she bore Jacob a sixth son. As far as we know, the mandrakes that Rachel's had have done nothing. They've done nothing. Because God is sovereign. I mean, it's not fruit, right? Fruit doesn't get people pregnant. Come on. Leah conceived again and bore Jacob a sixth son. Leah said, God has endowed me with a good endowment. My husband will honor me because I've borne him six sons. She called him Zebulun. Zebulun sounds like the Hebrew word for endowment or gift. It's from a verb that is similar to that, which is probably why the name comes after this statement about the husband who will honor her in this gift or endowment that God has given. In verse 21, afterward, she bore a daughter. So son after son after son. You've had six sons from one woman. And then their seventh child, a boy. A boy. I'm beginning to wonder in our own family if that's the order that it's going to take. Six sons before one girl. But that's okay. You know, three boys so far, three more boys to go, and then the daughter. And then Leah's great desire for her husband has no doubt been maintained. She would love to be loved, love to be wanted. And yet, Rachel is the preferred wife, and yet the one who has been barren. This daughter that Leah has is named Dinah. The word Dinah is probably the female equivalent of Dan, which means vindication or judgment. So the word Dinah is basically Leah saying with the naming of this daughter, God has given a judgment for me, on my behalf, a vindication. She has seven children. Seven was an important number, of course, in the Old Testament. I don't know that you could argue parentally that seven children is the perfect number. The perfect number is probably the number that you can handle. He already has four wives, more than he can handle. Now, almost 12 children, 11 so far with Dinah. Dinah's name here is not given any significance, though, with the name. That's why I had to say that according to Old Testament scholars, it's the female equivalent of Dan. Notice all the sons get some sort of explanation. All it tells us in verse 21 is that she bore a daughter and called her name Dinah. That's all we get. But this is foreshadowing because in Genesis 34, Dinah is going to have an important role in that story. And she's going to be defiled. And her name is introduced here so that the reader already knows this is a daughter of Jacob through Leah. But here's the climax of the story. And it comes full circle, doesn't it? Because at the beginning of the passage, we learned that Rachel was barren. Well, here it tells us in verse 22, then God remembered Rachel. And when the Bible declares that God remembered, it's not because he forgot. That's not the word remember, what the word remembrance means. It's a covenant word and a promise-keeping word. God has sought to intervene at this point, to exercise his power, to display his covenant-keeping character and promises. And so not only has he shown favor on Leah, he's now going to open Rachel's womb. And it says God remembered Rachel and God listened to her and opened her womb. And this means she, in verse 23, conceived and bore a son. Well, it had nothing to do with mandrakes, did it? It had nothing to do with sweet-smelling fruit that had some various legends surrounding it. No, it was God. It was God for Leah, and it was God in Rachel's case. And what she says in verse 23 and 24 is about taking away and adding. Okay, subtraction and addition. And let's look at how the play on words works. In verse 23, first, the subtraction. God has taken away my reproach. Because in that day, if the woman could not have a child, it was the end of the family line. And socially, she would bear disgrace because of this stigma. And so God has taken away my reproach, she says, because this womb is now opened. But not only has God removed one thing, she's praying that God would add another. In verse 24, she called the son's name Joseph. Now, this also is foreshadowing. And it's really important because Joseph is given a whole section of narratives from chapters 37 to the end. He is the dominant character of what happens in Egypt. And his birth is mentioned here, the son of Rachel. She called his name Joseph, saying, may the Lord add to me another. So God has taken away one thing and may he add another. And this seems to have a kind of prophetic element to it because she indeed will bear another son. She's going to bear Benjamin a few chapters from now. So she names him Joseph. Though in faith, may the Lord add to me another son, hoping for someone beyond Joseph. What we find out is that the word Joseph means may he add. The word Joseph means may he add. So she called his name Joseph. May the Lord add to me another son. So even within the name Joseph, the reader gets this sense that this is not the end of children for Rachel. God's going to answer this prayer in due course. Ending the chapter, or ending the passage that way, is also significant because it's forward-looking. May the Lord add to me another son. That means we're looking for something else. What's God going to do? What's God going to grant? What is his power going to show? What story is he going to tell? the overcoming of barrenness and the preservation of these promises and God's covenant-keeping character on display here takes us all the way to Jesus. And when Leah is talking in chapter 29, Leah says in chapter 29, chapter 29, 35, "This time I will praise the Lord," and she calls his name Judah. Another important place that where she speaks is later in Genesis 30, in verse 13, when Leah's servant Zilpah bore Jacob a son. "Happy am I, for women have called me happy." And some scholars have noted that it's interesting of a woman calling someone happy or calling someone blessed is language that's used later in Luke's gospel about another woman in an interesting marriage situation where God was bringing about the birth of a child by his power. And here's what Mary says in Luke's gospel, chapter 1, verse 48. I'll start a little bit before verse 48. In Luke 1, 46, Mary says, "My soul magnifies the Lord, and my spirit rejoices in God my Savior, for he's looked upon the humble estate of his servant. From now on, all generations will call me blessed." So it's one thing for women to call Leah happy. It's another thing for all generations to call Mary blessed. It's an escalation, isn't it? It's an escalation from a much more restricted, limited view of things. And then what God did through Mary. Oh, what God was doing in Jacob's family was something to behold for sure. The nation of Israel was coming. Oh, but friends, when God did what he did through the Virgin Mary, the fulfillment of Israel had arrived. The culmination of all of that story. So when you compare these things, you can see, whereas these tribes that will descend from these names on the board, adding Benjamin as well, and a couple other tweaks, but in general the principle stands, the tribes that come are going to be for the nations that they might come to know God. And ultimately from these lines, and from Judah's tribe in particular, will come the royal Messiah, our anointed one, who is indeed God's gift and mercy for the nations. Israel was set apart, and these tribes would be the heads of the tribes they were, and the stories that unfolded would be the stories they were, because they were all leading to that place in Bethlehem and beyond, when the story of Jesus would be told. We should praise the Lord for his faithfulness, for his covenant-keeping character and promises, and for seeing amid the difficulty and the strife and the family tensions and the marriage difficulties that no doubt Jacob had, and we're only getting a glimpse of them, 7 years of this, four wives, 12 children, friends, God was at work. They could not yet fathom all that he would do in taking what was going on in that home and leading it to a place where the Savior would be born. We should rejoice, marvel, and worship. Let's pray together.